It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to WPR's resident technology expert. If your computer is running slow, he's got some tips to speed things up.
First, though, we look at two big political announcements that took place in the state today. For months, the name of former Trek executive Mary Burke kept coming up as a possible Democratic candidate for governor. She made it official this morning in a video press release.
Also today, Wisconsin Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen said he won't seek a third term in 2014. Like it or not, the political season is officially underway for next year.
Mary Spicuzza is the state government reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. She joins us to talk about these announcements. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, despite not having much of a political background, there was already considerable talk about Mary Burke entering the race before today. What do we know about her so far?
Well, we got an email promptly at 5 a.m. This morning. I was up with my daughter, and it popped up pretty early with a video message. She's been working with a PR spokesman, Joe Zepecki. It's been widely speculated that she would be getting in the race, so I think people probably would have been more surprised if she decided not to run at this point, but she obviously has a name with Trek Bicycles, with school issues, and it seems like she's been doing quite a bit of research about whether to get in the campaign, you know, over the last few months, and just made it official today. And then shortly, you know, it's kind of been a busy morning with about 4 hours later, J.B. Van Hollen announces that he is not running. Another quiet day in Wisconsin politics.
Well, she is not necessarily a stranger to state politics, though we just heard in our newscast that she was the Commerce Secretary under Governor Doyle. What kind of knowledge base does that bring for her in this campaign season?
You know, it's interesting because Republicans have seized on that. She was Commerce Secretary under Jim Doyle. She was not the only Commerce Secretary under Jim Doyle, but, Republicans are trying to link her, saying that she's part of the failed policies of Jim Doyle, and we've gotten quite a series of press releases this morning from them calling her Madison Millionaire Mary Burke or Out of Touch Mary Burke. So they've certainly been, not shy about putting out releases on her.
Well, in fact, it looks like the Republican Party of Wisconsin already took hold of the domain name MaryBurke.com.
Yes. Yeah, they did. So I guess that is, I'm sure her campaign is probably kicking themselves for not getting that sooner. I believe she has Burke for Wisconsin.
Oh. Well, one of the criticisms among Democrats of the Republican Party and some big-time Republican candidates in the state is their ties to money. What might her millionaire status mean for supporters of the Democratic Party? Do you think it would reflect poorly on her in some way?
You know, I know that in the past some critics of Governor Walker have said that they don't think the Democratic candidate should just be someone who has enough money to run against him, that money shouldn't decide politics. I think a lot of political observers say, well, money shouldn't decide politics, but when you're looking at campaign ads and literature and all of those things cost money, and Governor Walker is, certainly has been able to bring in a large amount of political contributions, which we've seen in his campaign and in the recall election. So I don't think it will necessarily hurt her that she has money to spend. But yes, some Democratic critics have said, this shouldn't just be about money.
Well, in August, Wisconsin Democratic Party Chairman Mike Tate said that if Burke jumped into the race, she would be an instant front runner. Do you foresee that that might be the case? I mean, is there any advantage to being the first to declare a candidacy within a party?
I think there is, and I think if there are people who are out there maybe thinking about it, who, have less money, who don't have money of their own to spend on political races, I think that that would probably be a deterrent. I don't think Senator Vinehout has said that she is not running. And I know that there had been some other names, although I have not heard of anybody, certainly not since Burke announced, saying that they're definitely going to run. So she could clear the field.
Yeah, we had just also heard in this newscast that Senator Vinehout hasn't backed away from her plan to announce sometime after the first of the year whether she's going to run. If there are any others waiting in the wings, what does Burke's announcement do for their timeline?
I think it moves it up because, you know, it really does feel like suddenly with her announcement and Van Hollen's announcement, it really does feel like we're back in campaign season. Which it's funny because it's only really been since, you know, I think a lot of us were doing election postmortems into December. And in Wisconsin, that kind of seems like a long break from covering campaigns mm-hmm. after all of the recalls. But I think that it's going to put pressure on people to get in or get out.
Well, looking back at the recall, there were four Democratic candidates vying to challenge Governor Scott Walker in the recall. Does the Democratic Party want another primary this time around, or would they rather have a clear-cut, strong candidate to put forth from the get-go?
You know, I think there were probably, looking back, Democrats would look at some things that they did in the recall and kind of wish they had done things differently. And I think that certainly beating each other up in a primary might be a rough way to head in against Scott Walker, who has obviously had a lot of support among conservatives, a lot of financial contributions from conservatives, and burning a ton of money in a primary might not be what a lot of Democrats are wanting to do right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. Many expected Mary Burke to announce her candidacy at some point, but we didn't necessarily expect Attorney General Van Hollen to say that he wasn't going to run for a third term. Did you see any signs of this
coming?
Not
necessarily on the
same day either. Yeah, right.
Right. You know, I guess there had been some speculation that he was not going to run, and you know, the Waukesha County District Attorney Brad Schimmel has said that he is very likely going to run and has been working with Darren Schmitz at Persuasion Partners looking into a run. So it makes me think that, you know, some people may have known that he was considering this, at least for a few weeks. But I don't think it was widely known that he wasn't going to run, and I think a lot of people are surprised by the news.
Well, if we were to have speculated into next year, would you have predicted that he would have been a strong candidate, or did you see that he might have been vulnerable as an incumbent?
Gosh, that is a very good question. I think certainly a lot of Democrats have not been happy with him over some of the policies that he has been charged with enforcing or defending in court, voter ID, Act 10. There's been an issue with Senator Leah Vukmir's records and the whole issue of public records and state open records requests. So I think that he has drawn a lot of criticism from Democrats, but certainly a lot of Republican statements today and Republicans have praised his work. So, you know, he may have been polarizing, but I don't necessarily know that. I think we're maybe just in a polarized time. So I don't know how strong of a candidate he would have been.
Well, and concealed carry was something that kind of came to pass, too, within the last few years. What do you think he'll be most remembered for?
I think that'll probably, again, depend on whether you ask a Republican or a Democrat that question. I think a lot of Democrats will say he was kind of accused him today, at least, of trying to suppress voters with voter ID or defending Act 10 in court. I think a lot of Republicans or supporters would say his efforts to crack down on child sex trafficking mm-hmm. or internet exploitation of children or clearing the DNA database. So again, I think it's pretty polarized with Republicans touting one set of accomplishments and Democrats criticizing some other things.
This is sort of a side note, but I believe he's also currently the head of the U.S. Attorneys General. So what happens to his term there?
I have not gotten an interview with him today. I'm waiting to hear back about whether I will or when I will get to interview him, but it doesn't sound like it's going to be today, so I think I'll have to hold off on that question until I find out.
And I'm sure he's fielding a lot of media inquiries today. So, well, as we mentioned in the intro, like it or not, the 2014 political season is underway now. What are you keeping a close eye on in the coming weeks?
I think we'll be keeping an eye on what other announcements we get or don't get from potential candidates for governor. I think we'll be checking in with the Waukesha County District Attorney and State Representative Chris Taylor about their possible plans for running for Attorney General. Representative Taylor did not say that she is officially in, but said that she was intrigued and would be talking with her family. The Waukesha District Attorney said that he was very likely going to run and expected to make announcement in the next few days and had been talking with his family. So I think those races, we could get some news in the very near future. There's always the endless speculation about whether Governor Walker will be running for president, so I'm sure we'll be keeping an eye on that too. And, you know, I guess we can't assume that people will be running for re-election, so we need to kind of check around.
It's an exciting time. Well, Mary, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Mary Spicuzza is state government reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal.
Coming up next, WPR's tech guy drops by. He has some advice on speeding up our lagging computers. You're listening to Central Time.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time now for some technology talk. If you've ever thrown up your hands in the air in frustration and yelled, "My computer is slow as heck and I can't take it anymore," we may have some help for you.
Kevin Trueblood is one of our technological types here at WPR. He keeps things working and shows us how to use them, too. He joins us every month or so on Central Time with helpful advice. Kevin, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, we're talking slow computers today. This is a common problem, right?
It is, and you would be amazed at how many people will say, "My computer used to run so well, and mm-hmm. now it takes 10 minutes. I go get a cup of coffee, and it comes back, and it's ready."
Now, we were talking before, and you said there's actually two separate problems. We're going to tackle them each in turn. What are the two things?
Yeah, well, what I hear a lot of from people is, my computer is slow, which is obviously a legitimate problem, but then sometimes people mistake their computer being slow for their internet being slow. So when they're trying to go to web pages, their computer is just fine, but they're not able to browse as fast as they would like, and they think their computer is broken.
All right. Well, let's start with the problems with the computer first.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just a case where maybe the computer's too darn old and there's nothing you can do about it?
That is a very common problem. You know, what happens is that as software evolves, and if you install new things, new software is designed for newer hardware. So it's designed for newer resources. And if you've got a machine that is 5, 6, 10 years old and you're putting brand new software on it, well, it may slow a lot of things down because it's designed to run on modern systems.
Well, assuming that isn't the problem or that isn't the whole problem, what kind of things can we look at to soup up our computer and get it running a little faster?
There's a whole lot of things that you can do. And
get your pens out, people.
Well, I mean, you could devote an entire hour to these kinds of problems because a lot of them are unique to an individual's machine. But there are a few common problems and a few common solutions to them. A lot of things that I see are add-ons, programs being installed when you intend to install one program. So for instance, if you're installing a PDF reader, it'll want to install several other things mm-hmm. along with it that you either ignore or you just keep clicking agree, install, and suddenly you've got 10 programs on your machine as opposed to one. So that happens a lot. So one of the common remedies to that is occasionally go through and in your control panel for Windows users, uninstall programs that you either don't recognize or you just don't use anymore. That oftentimes will help clear up space and often will speed things up.
Is that still the add remove programs thing in the control panel, or am I like 10 years out of date?
No, that is. In XP, it is uninstall programs. In Windows 7, I think they renamed it to programs and features, and then there's an option in there to uninstall programs. So that's one of the common things. The other thing a lot of people have is they have commercial antivirus software. And that's great. We definitely want people to be protected. But a lot of times those have an effect of slowing the machine down. Those have gotten very big and they're trying to do a lot. They're trying to scan your email. They're trying to constantly protect your machine. And a lot of times those can get very big and slow your machine down. And similarly, if you are the type that shuts your machine down overnight and you boot up your machine first thing in the morning, and it wants to do a daily scan, the first thing it's going to do is scan your computer. So that's another thing. And oftentimes that will significantly slow your machine down while it's constantly scanning files.
Well, what do I do about that then?
Well, you can either leave your machine on all day if you've got it set for to scan on a daily basis, or you can set the daily scan to be at a time when you're not normally using your machine. So if you say start up your machine every morning at 7 a.m., you and it's on all day and say you go to work or you come home or you leave the house for a little while, you can set it for the time that you're constantly gone.
Now, how about the other end of that? Are viruses one of the possible reasons our computers are working slowly?
Oh, absolutely. And that's part of it, too. You want to make sure you are doing those scans. And there's lots of different what we call malware programs, anti-malware programs. Malware is software that installs on your machine unknowingly that suddenly is giving you pop-ups or is constantly annoying you. Those can definitely slow it down. So you want to install anti-malware software. There's things like Super Anti-Spyware and Malware Bytes are some of the most common ones that are also free that you can use to get rid of those.
Hey, what if, going back to getting rid of programs, what if we accidentally get rid of something we should not have done?
Well, there's probably not too much unless you uninstall Windows that's going to severely disable your machine. But if you say accidentally uninstall Office or something like that, if you have the original install disks, then you can usually reinstall it and no real harm unless you say delete everything. A lot of programs, if you uninstall it, will say, are you sure you want to install everything? Or it'll just leave certain files there so that if you reinstall it or the save files that you created using that software, then it's typically not a problem to reinstall it.
All right. The tips you just talked us through, every ordinary folks can do that, or should they bring in a pro?
Well, you could certainly go either way. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, there are certainly lots of stores and companies that offer that kind of service to speed that up for you. But that's a lot of the things that they'll do is they'll go through and uninstall anything that you don't need to be running. Or it suggests upgrading hardware. If you've got an older machine, simple things that you can do are upgrading what's called the RAM, which is temporary memory in your machine that programs use while they're actively running. The more memory you have, the better you're going to be able to do more things at once. So you can have a couple, three programs running at a time and everything's running smoothly. The more memory you have is going to allow you to do more things simultaneously.
Just like in our brains.
Correct.
Or maybe not. Anything else on the computer end? Should we move on to the internet's too darn slow?
Well,
for
a couple
now.
Other things I was going to point out. Another common or another thing that now that the hardware prices have come down so well is you can look at upgrading to what's called a solid state drive. And those are basically like a thumb drive that you have. A lot of people have little portable drives that you plug into your USB port. They've now gotten a lot bigger and it can speed up your computer significantly just by installing these things. I've had machines that are 5-6 years old that suddenly have a new lease on life.
Wow.
That are a whole lot faster.
Okay, now suppose the problem isn't the computer, it's the internet. What are a few of the things we should be looking at to speed that up?
Well, there's a couple of things you can look at. First of all, if you are somebody who has a lot of people in your house and you have, say, Wi-Fi set up in your house, sometimes people are just using the internet a lot. If somebody is streaming video files, if somebody is downloading something, if you have multiple people doing things, that can make things slower. And this is also presuming that it was once fast and now it's slow. If you ordered a DSL service that's not very fast, well, from the beginning, that's probably what you have to work with. Mm-hmm. But if you've noticed that over time it's started to slow down, that's one thing you may look at. If you do have Wi-Fi, and let's say you're using your laptop and you're saying, my internet's just going to a crawl, check your signal strength. Oftentimes, like in Windows, you'll see in the lower right corner by the clock, you'll see a little signal strength meter. And if that little meter is really tiny, if there's only one or two bars, if you have a weak signal, it will slow down your internet. You won't be able to connect as effectively because you're so far away from the Wi-Fi access point. And so move your access point or move closer to where the Wi-Fi is originating from.
Anything else on the internet end apart from checking that Wi-Fi and not overloading it?
Well, that and also look for browser bars. And this is something I had mentioned earlier. If you install programs and suddenly it wants to add on a bunch of things, a lot of times they'll want to install things that are like browser bars, like Google search bar or any kind of utility bars. They will want to install these little bars that, you know, they may be helpful. So if, you know, like the Google bars, you can search Google right from that bar. But a lot of times that's analyzing what you're doing on the internet from that bar. That's why there's a lot of incentive into installing them onto your machine. So make sure those are disabled or those are uninstalled because those, if you've got 10 of them running simultaneously, that's going to not only minimize your internet window, how big of a browser space you have, but also slow things down for you.
That's when I think I need to check out back in my office. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Kevin Trueblood, our resident technology guy.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a Frontline documentary confronts the issue of concussions in pro football. We'll talk to the director.
We'll hear from a Madison poet who's paying tribute to an overlooked jazz legend, the pianist, the composer, the band leader, Mary Lou Williams.
And we'll find out how solving the problem of food waste could help in the fight against world hunger.
You can watch the Central Time Facebook page for more updates as to what's coming up. All that's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later in the program, we'll be talking about the science of impulse and why it feels so good, at least for a time, to eat that piece of chocolate or buy that tabloid at the checkout counter.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. While Wisconsin is known for its beer, we also love brandy, and many of the state's new craft distillers are now making their own local version of the drink. Producer Seth Jovag went to Mitchell Vineyards with staff and volunteers from Madison's Old Sugar Distillery to pick about 10 tons of grapes.
No state drinks more brandy per capita than Wisconsin, but not all brandies are alike. While most of the world's grape brandy is distilled in California, the rise of craft distilleries has brought brandy production a little closer to home. Each year, Nathan Greenwalt from Old Sugar Distillery in Madison and a troop of paid volunteers pick about 10 tons of grapes at Mitchell Vineyards near Oregon.
We come out here with as many volunteers as we can muster and pick close to 100 pounds per hour. So if we can get enough volunteers, we can do close to 8,000 pounds in a day.
Oh, just keep picking.
Today we picked about 6,000 pounds, primarily Foch and Malo grapes, which are French hybrid grapes that have been developed by the University of Minnesota. They taste like French grapes, but that'll grow in this climate, so they're nice, high-quality red wine grapes. We're picking up all the full buckets from the down the rows. The pickers go around and do their picking and leave the buckets behind for us to pick up with the ATV. Those grapes are crushed on-site here at the farm. And they're crushed into plastic totes, which we take to the distillery, and we add yeast, and we get that grape must fermenting.
You ready?
Yeah. All right, go ahead, George. That's the crusher destemmer. Fairly small but very efficient way of crushing the grapes. You don't want to grind them. You just want to crack them open. And then it also separates the stems. These grapes will be fermented and then distilled, and that spirit will be aged in toasted barrels and then moved, after most of the aging, to used charred rum barrels.
When you make brandy, you are essentially making wine that is then distilled.
So we've got our still fired up here. It's a 220-gallon modified pot still. What goes in is usually about 14% alcohol, basically a wine that's made either from grapes if we're doing brandy, or sugar if we're doing rum or one of our liqueurs. Basically, we're boiling off the alcohol. The still is made down in Arkansas by a guy who calls himself Colonel Wilson. He's kind of a character. This is last year's brandy. It's got a real nice, delicate aroma. Well, you can smell a little vanilla that comes through from the oak barrels, but also just kind of a delicate grape flavor that comes through from the fermentation and distillation. Yeah, the grapes are great. People's palates are kind of accustomed to Cabernet and Merlot. These are going to taste a little different. They're very earthy, which I think makes for a really great brandy.
Nobody really knows why brandy is so popular in Wisconsin. And while most of that brandy is consumed in a cocktail like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, these craft distilleries may just change the way Wisconsin drinks.
Yeah, it's definitely a draw. I mean, anything that's made this locally is a pretty easy sell, since Wisconsin's a big brandy state, especially since it tastes so good.
That was producer Seth Jovag. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more info, go to wisconsinlife.org.
Here to talk about some other Wisconsin-made spirits is Adam Casey. He's a manager at Star Liquor in Madison and a founding member of the Madison Malt Society. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, we know that Wisconsinites love their beer.
True.
How does our love for craft liquor compare?
It's definitely a growing trend in the state of Wisconsin right now. It's something that we have seen growing all around the country over the last 5 or 6 years. There are now about 15 different distilleries based in Wisconsin, and it has been something we have watched growing pretty dramatically. Part of the reasoning we see it happening is craft beer actually broke down a lot of the walls for these distilleries. People are more interested in tasting new things. The whole buying local is always an interesting thing here in Madison. People are excited to try it.
Well, you know, we just heard about the Old Sugar Distillery in Madison. What are some other distilleries in the capital area?
In Madison, we have three distilleries off the top of my head. Old Sugar, obviously. We also have Yahara Bay, which is down towards Fitchburg. And we also have Death's Door, which is out in Middleton. Both making a lot of different products. I believe I was talking to Nick Quint from Yahara Bay the other day, and I think they're up to 15 different products there right now, ranging from vodka to gin to limoncello to apple brandy and things of that like. So there's a really great variety of products we can find here that are made locally.
I learned the hard way that Death's Door is not on Washington Island.
No. Death's Door is here in Madison. they were originally, the idea came from using some of the wheat that is grown on Washington Island from the hotel. I had spoken to the chef there years ago, and she said, well, you know, you can only make so many buckwheat pancakes before you need to come up with some other idea.
That's funny.
And the idea came to making vodka and gin and whiskey is what Death's Door is doing these days.
So anyone who's headed to the ferry right now,
right?
I would imagine
you can probably find.
I hope you've learned soon enough.
But,
unlike myself,
yes.
I got all the way up there, and they said, actually, they're in Madison. Oh, okay.
Yes, the distillery is over in Middleton. So if you're on your way there, you might want to take a U-turn.
Well, how many distilleries are there, and you know, what more beyond you know, brandy and vodka and gin is starting to come out?
You can find basically any distilled product that's made here in Wisconsin. We don't make tequila because we can't grow agave here in Wisconsin. Mm. That pretty much has to be down in the South. In fact, even the Southwest has a little trouble because the climate's just not quite right for it. But there's gin, there's vodka, brandy, whiskey, limoncello, apple brandy. Yahara Bay is coming out with a cranberry liqueur called a crancello. So there's a really, really huge variety of products you can have. Flavored vodkas, things like that. There's a gentleman up near Green Bay that's making flavored rums. Mm-hmm. There's a guy in Sturgeon Bay named Po Lo who has a traditional Hmong rice spirit called Yer Lo. That's about as unique as it gets. Until you've tried it, you can't even imagine what it's like. It's really an interesting product. And basically what he's trying to do is maintain his family's heritage through products that come from his background.
Well, you know, you just mentioned the rice spirit. There's also Door Peninsula Winery has gone into distilling over the last few years, and they're starting to come up with these specialty liqueurs as well. Vodka, whiskey, rum, these are sort of mainstays in cocktails. What resources are available for people who might want to branch out and try specialty liqueurs but don't know how to use them?
Well, I think one of the real advantages that the craft distilling trend has seen is the fact that cocktails are becoming more and more popular around the country. The trend in restaurants and bars in Madison seems to be to always have a specialty cocktail list, and that definitely influences what people are willing to try and then go out and buy and take home themselves. There are websites galore that will tell you about cocktails. Most of the websites for the distilleries that are based here in Wisconsin or anywhere in the country for that matter will include some sort of cocktail recipes and things like that. Mm-hmm. It definitely shows the ability to branch out and really use these products in interesting ways. I've been selling liquor for almost 13 years now, and some of the things these guys come up with just blow me out of the water. I never saw any of that coming, so.
When in doubt, do you recommend just kind of sipping it straight from the glass?
Well, I think that's the best way to get your first taste of a product, maybe. One of the things the Madison Malt Society does every year is we put on an event called Distill America for charity that we use as sort of a trade show, sort of a sampling where people can come in and they can try as many of these different products as they want to, within reason, of course. It does take a level of responsibility and taking care of yourself when sampling distilled spirits. But, I mean, with the variety of products out there, that's a nice way to do it. I always say with any spirit or distillate, have it the way you like it. If you like a gin and tonic, have a gin and tonic. If you want a rum and coke, have a rum and coke. You know, something like that is not a bad idea. But it's always fun to taste the product by itself just to get a real idea of what you're getting into.
Well, one distillery that I hadn't heard of was 45th Parallel.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that?
45th Parallel is up in New Richmond, Wisconsin. It's up north of Eau Claire. And 45th Parallel makes some really great products, things like vodka and gin. They also make, for another company, they make a horseradish-infused vodka. Which
really?
Is, yeah, one of the
can't
more...
can't even imagine.
You can't. And you know what? I couldn't either when I first heard of it. I thought it was just going to clear my sinuses when I tried it. But it's actually a very elegant product. It's called Referent horseradish-infused vodka, and it makes about the best Bloody Mary you could ever imagine. I always thought, I haven't done this before, but I've always considered pairing it with oysters, too. I thought that would be really good.
Wow. Well, that's something to keep our eye out for.
Yeah,
well,
always something out there.
Thanks for telling us about that.
Sure.
That's Adam Casey. He's manager at Star Liquor in Madison and a founding member of the Madison Malt Society.
Coming up next, why are we more likely to act on impulse rather than logic? And is that necessarily a bad thing? We'll talk to a leading researcher about the science of impulse. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about some of the issues facing the Supreme Court, which started its new term today.
But first, how many times have you said to yourself, well, that seemed like a good idea at the time? Probably more than a couple. According to our next guest, we're much more likely to act on impulse than reason or logic, even though we like to think of ourselves as real rational type creatures.
But he also says that's not necessarily a bad thing. The impulsive decisions actually might have an ability to enrich our lives.
We're joined now by David Lewis. He's founder and director at Mind Lab International at the Sussex Innovation Center. He's the author of Impulse, Why We Do What We Do Without Knowing Why We Do It. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, good afternoon.
So when we talk about impulse, it usually, I think, is in a negative way. Like, I did that bad thing, it was an impulse. But it can be a good thing, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Because when we're sort of acting on impulse, or acting on autopilot, as it were, we're tapping into resources deep in our subconscious. And we may know things that in this level of the brain, which we actually don't know at a conscious level. So very often, you know, you have a gut reaction to somebody. You like them or you dislike them. At a sort of first meeting. I don't know if you remember the show MASH, television show, some years ago now, but there was a wonderful line in it which has always stuck in my mind. There's a very unpopular officer there, I think called Henry, and he asks, why does everybody take an instant dislike to me? And the reply is, because it saves us so much time. And I think sometimes, you know, you get a feeling somebody, your skin crawls always, and you meet them, or you think, wow, this is a really nice person, I'm sure we could be friends. And this is often tapping into kind of emotional responses which are deeply embedded in your brain, so you don't really know why you feel that way, or you go out and buy something. You don't really know at the time why you've bought it. And as you said in your introduction, well, you have to say, well, it just seemed like a good idea at the time. Sometimes it is, and sometimes, of course, it's a disaster.
Well, can you break that down for us? What is actually happening in our brains that drives these impulses?
Well, essentially, most of what we do, an awful lot of what we do, is done more or less on autopilot. Some neuroscientists have described it as our zombie brain. This is the brain which operates without conscious awareness. So that's perfectly okay. So, you know, you're commuting into work, perhaps, and while you're driving along, you're driving perfectly safely, but you're not really thinking about driving because you're an experienced motorist, so you're able to sort of think about what you're going to be doing when you get into work, or maybe if you're coming home from work, what you're going to be doing when you get back home. And so half of your brain is actually thinking about other things. Because it's a well-learned response, you're able to do it perfectly safely. And a lot of the things we can do on autopilot like this, and this saves the brain a huge amount of energy. The brain is actually a very energy-conserving organ. It operates on less power than the average household light bulb. And it does an awful lot of this because it has sort of algorithms or heuristics, rules of thumb, which it follows. And, you know, 80% of the time they'll work fine. But occasionally, of course, you do something which is just darn silly. Perhaps you have an accident or something because you weren't being what is called mindful. You really weren't attending to it. And an awful lot of accidents happen simply because we're attending to other things and not to what we're doing.
Well, this is a challenge to our self-image, isn't it? I mean, we kind of think of ourselves, or I think of myself as this guy who thinks about things and makes conscious decisions in most things I do, but not really.
Well, no, not, I think, to the extent that we'd like to believe. We believe we act very rationally, but very often what we do is sort of do what you might call a post hoc justification. We've behaved in a certain way, and then we have to explain it to ourselves and the rest of the world. And indeed, one philosopher of science has said that, in a sense, the brain of the frontal cortex, the frontal part of the brain, is a bit like a PR, a public relations officer, trying to explain to the world why we behaved and why the company behaved in a particular way. And often, this sort of PR is operating on disinformation or the wrong information or very little information. So we're trying to have to invent a narrative about why we do things. And sometimes, you know, there have been occasions. In fact, the reason I came to be interested in this subject as a neuroscientist was because way back in the 1970s, in 1971, in fact, I wasn't working as a scientist. I was actually working as a science reporter. And I was out in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, in Belfast at the time of the Troubles, as they called them. And I had arranged to meet a family who I was doing a story, basically, on how the Troubles, the fighting and the bombings, what the impact they were having on children and teenagers. And I arranged to meet a family with a 14-year-old daughter. And on my way to the meeting, it was just coming up to Christmas. It was the 4th of December. It was very cold, very miserable. I felt really depressed. So I thought, on an impulse, I'd go to the cinema, which I did. As a result of going to the cinema, I arrived about 20 minutes late for my appointment. And very tragically, the building in which I was going to have that meeting was blown up. And a lot of people were killed. And had I not, on an impulse, gone to the cinema, I might well, it's very likely I would have been killed as well. So that really got me thinking, you know, sometimes we do things and it's almost like people will say, well, I had this sort of intuition that something bad was going to happen if I stepped on that aircraft or if I got into that car, and something bad does happen. And you think, well, you know, maybe I had this kind of foresight. I don't think it's that. It's just that on that occasion, you happen to have this impulse which made you do something. And because of the way things turned out, you kind of attributed some kind of, you know, sort of intervention on somebody else's behalf.
But maybe on that same day, you had tens or even hundreds of other impulses that didn't stand out because they didn't keep you from being killed in a terrorist attack.
Well, exactly so. So we remember the things where there's some very good outfit. Also, on an impulse, you might buy a lottery ticket, and you know, it wins you a fortune. You think, wow, what an amazing... But, you know, maybe hundreds of times before you made an impulsive purchase, which hadn't turned out so well. So very often, it's the way the impulse has actually turned out. Let me give you an example. I think many of your listeners maybe know of Tower Bridge, which is a very famous bridge in London, where the actual arms of the bridge raise up to let ships go underneath. And many years ago, a London bus, a big double-decker bus, if your listeners are familiar with these big buses, it was traveling across this bridge, and the bridge started to lift. And the driver had to either push his foot on the accelerator and hope he could jump this bus, which weighed several tons, over the gap, which now were yawning under his front wheels, or slam on the brakes and hope he could stop. And he decided to try and jump the bus over the gap. And he, amazingly, because this bus is very heavy and they don't go very fast, managed to do this. And he landed safely on the other side. I think one passenger broke a limb, but everybody else was saved. And you know, so for that impulse, he was rewarded and seen as a hero. But if he failed to make the jump and he'd gone into the Thames and killed everybody, you see, that would have been seen as a terrible thing to have done. So it's very often how the impulse turns out is the way we judge it as a very good or very bad impulse.
Well, you've investigated two kinds of thinking that occur in the brain called System I and System R. Could you talk about those and the relationship between the two?
Well, certainly. System I is, I've called it System I. It's called by different psychologists different things. It's been called System 1 and System 2, but I call it System I and System R because it's kind of easier to remember. System I stands for intuition, instinctive, impulsive thinking, and System R is rational and reasonable thinking. So we engage System R whenever we have, say, a math problem to do or something where we really have to think very hard about it. And thinking is very hard work, so whenever we can, we kind of use the System I, and we just essentially make a guess at it. And sometimes these guesses, as I say, can be very, very good. If you're a highly experienced professional, say you're a doctor, or you're an art specialist, you may instantly have an idea what is wrong with the patient, or that a piece of art you're looking at is a fake. And although you can't really immediately say why you think that, you just have this kind of gut feeling. So, you know, coming back to what I was saying earlier, these system I's can work very well on many occasions. System R engages much more energy in the brain. It's actually much more time consuming, and we tend to restrict this to things where we really have to focus our minds on problems. And very often we come up with an answer which seems right, but we really haven't sorted through correctly. We've actually relied on System I when we should have been operating on System R and taken a more balanced, more mindful view of it.
But sometimes System R could get us into trouble. I think in your book you give the example of the Williams sisters playing tennis. If they stopped at each stroke and said, I'm going to wind my arm back and hit it at a 43-degree angle, the ball would be in the next county by the time they acted.
You're absolutely right. In fact, if you want to really, really spook your opponent when you're playing, let's say, tennis, it would work with any game, I guess. You say, if somebody has served and you've missed their serve, you say, wow, that was absolutely an amazing serve. What an amazing, you are a really good player. How did you do that? You see, so now the next time they're going to serve.
How did I do that?
How did I do that? They're going to be thinking about it. And you know, if you kind of dive off a high board, if you think about how you're supposed to arrange your legs and your arms when you're heading towards the water, you're going to belly flop. So really at that time, you have to just trust your body and trust your training and trust, you know, your instincts and do it. So sometimes trying to use System R when you should be using System I can be as bad as doing it the other way around. But it's interesting. I mean, we've looked at a lot about it, kind of impulsive falling in love at first sight. And there's an interesting story because when Charles Darwin got married, when he came off the Beagle, having been on this 5-year voyage around the world, and he decided he ought to get married. So he got a sheet of paper and he wrote a list. He drew a line down the middle. On one side, he wrote reasons to marry. And on the other side, he wrote reasons not to marry. And he did this kind of cost-benefit analysis.
How romantic.
Well, it was, wasn't it?
And we might have to pick up that story after we check the news. We're talking with David Lewis about the science of impulse, and we want to hear from you. Can you remember a recent experience where you acted impulsively? Tell us what happened and how you felt about it afterwards. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll take your calls right after this check of the news. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.